Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journey.
The private marketplace for investment in the world totals something like $76 trillion compared to maybe $150 to $200 billion for development, primarily in the nonprofit development organizations. So the way to reach scale is to use the methods of multinational businesses, but to create a new model of multinational business, which we're trying to do with the three businesses that we've initiated. If you want to reach 100 million $2 a day customers, you've got to select problems that have a potential of perhaps a billion customers. There are many of those problems.
I'm very pleased today to introduce Paul Polak. Paul is the co-founder and CEO of Windhorse International, a for-profit social venture that designs radically affordable, life-saving or income-generating technology to serve the poorest people in the world. In 2008, Polak founded DREV, a non-profit with the aim of designing and delivering medical products to people living on less than $4 a day. Paul is also the co-author with Mal Warwick of Out of Poverty.
Thank you very much, Paul, for taking the time to speak to Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs today. It's a great privilege to have an opportunity to speak to you and get some insights on your long journey and work that you have been doing in, the whole area of development in various forms over the years. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the work that you do at Windhorse and give us a little bit of a picture of your approach there. And then maybe we can talk about some of the things that you think that are most interesting and happening, changing in this world at the moment.
Sure. Well, Windhorse is a business meant to be a frontier multinational that transforms the livelihoods of at least 100 million $2 a day customers, generates profit, and creates a model for a new values-oriented, profitable multinational corporation. The basic model came out of the work of IDE, where after trying a number of different approaches to end poverty for dollar-a-day farmers, what emerged is that creating new markets serving poor customers seemed to be the most effective way of reaching scale. Windhorse is a Western holding company located in Colorado, where I live. It in turn owns a majority interest in Spring Health, which is an Indian company. And Spring Health has the mission of selling safe drinking water to 100 million $2 a day rural customers especially in the eastern Indian Gangetic Plain. At an affordable price and making money doing it. At the present time, Spring Health serves over 149,000 individuals in 29,000 families in the state of Orissa, otherwise known as Odisha in eastern India. And this is in 160 villages. I'll be glad to give you more details if that's of interest.
Excellent. That sounds very interesting. And you mentioned this a few times, I think, the idea of scale and the idea of here, particularly with Spring Health, the ambition to impact 100 million people. How important is it to set these big goals and to set the whole scale at that level?
I think it's critical to, from my perspective. Scale is the single biggest unmet challenge of development today. With IDE, by using a business approach, but in this case, IDE is a development NGO or nonprofit. We reach 20 million customers and help them move out of poverty. That's individuals. But 20 million compared to between 2 and 3 billion individuals in the world living on less than $2 a day is just a drop in the bucket. So what I learned from talking to some $3,000 a day families in developing countries is that improving livelihoods is what they consider their most important vector to move out of poverty. So we took the what we learned from IDE's work over the first 25 years and distilled the key learning as creating new markets. So what we're doing now is creating models for three new businesses, of which Windhorse is one. The other two are in energy. But the only way I think that you can reach scale is to attract investors. The private marketplace for investment in the world totals something like $76 trillion compared to maybe $150 to $200 billion for development, primarily in with nonprofit development organizations. So the way to reach scale is to use the methods of multinational businesses, but to create a new model of multinational business, which we're trying to do with the three businesses that we've initiated.
Great, great. And how is that going? What are your insights into that? It's a great ambition. It's a worthy and transformational one. What are you finding some of the challenges? Because these problems are, I guess, they call them developments, and they call them wicked problems and complex. And very often companies are operating in environments with lack of infrastructure and very complex environments.
Well, the challenges are many, but the key is to approach the challenges with people from the areas themselves as staff. I'll just list some of the key challenges. The first is, of course, achieving scale, but I think that the way to approach that is to only select problems that if the strategy that you develop is successful, have millions of customers, so that we assume that we might be able to achieve 10% market penetration if successful. So we only, if you want to reach 100 million $2 a day customers, you've got to select problems that have a potential of perhaps a billion customers. There are many of those problems. There are more than a billion people who lack access to safe drinking water, more than a billion who lack access to safe sanitation facilities, toilets, more than a billion who will probably never connect to electricity, more than a billion that lack access to decent, affordable healthcare services, education. There are many, many of these problems. So the first is to select problems to address that have about a billion $2 a day customers. The second key issue is the so-called last mile distribution, which I call last 500 feet. You have to develop or design a business strategy that can reach the customers in small villages and make money doing it. I think we're pretty close to being there in the case of drinking water. Third issue is affordability. People who live on $2 a day can't afford Mercedes-Benz or Rolls-Royce type of solutions. So it's quite challenging but very doable to design technologies and strategies that are affordable to $2 a day customers who always are short, desperately short of capital to invest. The other feature that's critical, especially for people at the bottom of the pyramid, for me the biggest challenge is helping $2 a day people double their income, is designing strategies and technologies that are income enhancing. The thing that people who live on less than $2 a day most look for is a way to significantly enhance their livelihood. So we look for technologies or services that bring at least a one-year payback. Ideally, investors who are poor, who buy the technology or service, get a 200% return in the first year. So those are some of the challenges, and there are practical ways of meeting those challenges at scale, and I'm glad to give examples. So far, each of the businesses that we start tends to go through three distinct phases. One is to design a proof of concept prototype and test it so that it works, and usually with multiple, with many different prototypes. Then if that works successfully, we go to the phase of putting it in the hands of the poor customers themselves, learning from their experience and modifying the business strategy as well as the technology so that it is profitable and scalable. Then the next phase is commercialization. We usually do an initial commercialization test, and we keep learning from customer experience and modifying our approach, which includes aspirational branding as a major component. And then the final stage is rapid scale, both in the first country that we choose and in many other countries. So those are the steps that we use, and it's critical to have a learning attitude on the part of each company so that the key leaders are ready to change on a dime as new information comes in, especially from customers and contacts.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Clearly, the focus of this podcast is with entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs. And I guess when you started out, that wasn't the term that was necessarily widely used. I'm just wondering, what do you think are the skills required to be a social entrepreneur? I know some people see it pretty much as an entrepreneur, but with, you know, obviously some clearly social and impact weighting. I mean, to what extent is it pretty similar to being an entrepreneur? To what extent do you think there's rather different skills and approach required?
I think it's the same basic skills, but most entrepreneurs who create successful businesses and do it in a mature market, it's a different set of challenges, because if you take, there are many entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, but that's a mature market, so that here you have to differentiate your innovation from maybe 100 other innovations, and you don't have to worry so much about creating a whole infrastructure for marketing, for branding, for distribution. There already is a very significant distribution network. If you produce a breakthrough, you have to stay ahead of the competition, and the competition keeps you on your toes because it changes every 6 weeks or every few months. On the other hand, if you're creating a new technology, let's say, serving $2 a day farmers in a remote part of Bihar, there isn't that much competition. There isn't as much competitive pressure, but you have to not only design a technology, let's say you're designing a new irrigation technology, you not only have to design the technology You have to design a way of marketing and communicating that technology, often in an area where there is no access to mass media, where many of the customers are illiterate. So you have to design a new marketing and branding strategy. There often are no last-mile distribution links, and the last mile is the most expensive part of getting the product out to the customer. You need constant feedback because you're innovating marketing, branding, and business strategy in addition to creating a technology that hasn't been created before. So I'll give you one example. In the water company Spring Health, which is in which Windhorse has a majority control, we were told that women in the rural villages in Orissa were not expected to walk more than 50 meters from their home because it was unseemly. I didn't believe it, but it's true. So our assumption that both men and women and boys and girls would come and fetch water at the shop actually didn't apply to most of half of the population. So we had to design ways of bringing water to people's homes and doing it profitably. That's just one example. So I think that the parameters in a market that has very poor infrastructure, perhaps dicey transport, lack of communication, and different values than what you're used to requires approaching everything with no bashfulness about being ignorant, and with a curiosity and a willingness and hunger to learn and to change every day based on new learnings from customers.
That's very interesting. I know that in one of your videos about, I think it was 12 steps for practical problem solving, and you talked about the importance of being on the ground and really understanding the needs of the people that you're trying to help. I think you also mentioned it's something that's not done as much as you might think. Why is that?
Well, I think that people have an inherent belief in being able to come up with a solution to a wicked problem just from scratch. But unless you know the customer and the context, you can't solve the problems of people who live on less than $2 a day in your office or in the classroom. You have to go to where the problem is, talk to the people who have the problem, and actually listen, which is much tougher. The listening part is a big challenge. You have to know everything there is to know about the specific context of the problem. The only way to do that is by going there and keeping your eyes and ears open and listening and having no preconceptions.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite a challenge as well to go in there with a fresh and open mind. You also mentioned, I think, that the importance of not reinventing the wheel. How well do you think social entrepreneurs are doing in terms of the flow of information on what other people are doing in similar areas, and how well are other companies, you know, adapting and taking these ideas and bringing them forward, do you think?
I think there's a sea change from when I started 30 years ago. At that point in time, commercial initiatives were seen as the enemy and as by many people as a root cause of poverty rather than as a potential solution. I'm really heartened by the large numbers of young people and students and seasoned entrepreneurs who I've met who are interested in making a difference, making an impact, and who are ready to go to the field and actually learn about the problem. A group of students at CU, for instance, designed a much more affordable solar electricity system. But then instead of just designing something that was more affordable, they went to Nicaragua and talked to customers, and it profoundly changed their attitude and their design. And more people are doing that. it's not easy because you're often placed in an environment that you're not familiar with. Some people are nervous about being in a place like Bihar. I was there during the election process, and we were stopped at many roadblocks by soldiers and who checked out the car to make sure that we weren't going to create an upheaval of some sort. It's just a different environment.
Yeah, I just came back from Bihar myself. I was in Bihar a month ago myself. Exactly the same experience.
Really? Where were you? Maybe we're in the same place.
Oh, various places. Bodh Gaya, Patna, Kishangarh, we went to quite a few places. We were staying for a week in Bodh Gaya, so we were in and around driving quite a bit. And yes, they were right in the middle of the election, so it was quite an intense time, I think, generally.
Did you get stopped a lot?
We did. We had guides with us and so forth. But, you know, it was innocuous but pervasive, I'd say.
And for people who aren't used to it, getting stopped with people with guns checking in your car can be a little anxiety-provoking, but it's just routine for people in the from Bihar.
That's right. And I think it's got an important role, I think, in the elections as well. It's an important state. There's a lot at stake there. But it's interesting what you were saying as well. And I think one of the things that seems to still be a challenge is funding these kind of businesses and funding this kind of growth. I suppose patient capital is one way of talking about it in terms of the kind of time frame in which investors are willing to recognize that it does take time to get the right model and, you know, to build it up. It seems to be still a problem, shall we say, a challenge. Do you see that changing, or what do you think?
The solutions, as I see it, in social impact, so-called social impact investing, are not the typical bankable solutions. And raising funds for the three global companies is one of the biggest challenges. I spend a big chunk of my time raising investment for these three companies. But I encountered the same challenge when I started with IDE using market approaches in Bangladesh. We fortunately were able to get involved with pretty advanced donors in this case, like Canadian CETA, some people in Canadian CETA who supported an initiative called Marketing Appropriate Technology, and the Swiss, in the form of Swiss Development Cooperation, were strong supporters of bringing the treadle pump to scale using market methods. In fact, we've gotten some forward-thinking investors in the three companies, but they're pretty scarce. There's a lot of interest in impact investing. It's a changing field, and I think it'll mature quickly. But I think that what's needed in creating whole new markets in methods using methods that are not conventional methods is a willingness to take big risks, to invest perhaps a smaller amount in a large number of companies, and then reinvest in those that are successful rather than being conservative, because it's a field that is still early in its development.
Well, absolutely. There's a lot of talk about this investment and there's foundations and there's various kinds of impact funds and so forth. And yet when I speak to social entrepreneurs, they say again and again that they're finding it very difficult, that it's the biggest thing, the most time-consuming, and they fall on deaf ears again and again. And people just talking generally, philosophically about the idea, but not actually willing to support them financially.
Yeah, and one of the biggest problems is that in many of the very areas that need commercial activity, there is a tremendous movement to provide big subsidies on the part of governments and nonprofit development organizations. So that, for example, in India now, there is a rapidly growing realization that $6 billion that the government of India spends to subsidize electric and diesel irrigation pumps needs to be replaced by solar. But the method of replacing the diesel and electric pumps, which make a big contribution to climate change and carbon emissions, is in turn heavily subsidized. So one of the things that we've worked on is creating a solar irrigation system that lifts groundwater and distributes it to plants. But there are so many subsidies made available by well-meaning development organizations, microcredit organizations, and government institutions. Some of the farmers who desperately need solar irrigation systems are being offered solar technology at a 90% subsidy, which in the end ruins the market and undercuts true scale. It's not necessary to do that. If you design with an eye to affordability, our initial beta tests of our solar irrigation systems indicate a 2-year payback, and we're fast approaching a 1-year payback without subsidy, with profit, including a profit for a fair profit for all of the participants in the distribution and the manufacturing process. And yet, we're having to compete with 90% subsidized solar systems.
Sometimes,
that's a real problem.
Yeah, it does sometimes seem that there are different approaches which aren't working so well together. As you say, it's for these markets to develop, they become sustainable, and that's obviously a key ingredient, that it's not about just providing a small amount of money and then in a certain number of years again and again. It's ideally, I suppose, that these become self-financing and sustainable in their own rights. You talked about, I think in one of your talks, about transformations in business and over many, many decades. I'm just wondering how fundamental you think the change that's taking place at the moment is with respect to social values in business, with respect to impact. Certainly the younger generation, they take this for granted, and it's an extremely important element for them in terms of whether they'd be part of an organization, you know, what social values and so forth are. To what extent do you see this really as a deep and profound change, and what do you see next?
Well, I think it's a change that is overdue, that is beginning to happen. There are many very responsible multinational corporations, but until we get away from using shareholder profits as the main and only yardstick, I don't think that transformation will take place. The interesting thing is that I think the transformation will be fueled by market forces themselves. For instance, when I started with treadle pumps with IDE in Bangladesh, the green movement and realization of the importance of the environment was in its infancy. Now we have an over move towards greenwash and some things that really are ridiculous. But I think that it's no longer possible for companies to not take into account the environmental impact of what they do and the environmental costs. That is increasingly being obvious, and it will be necessary for companies, in order to survive, to take into account the common good as well as profit. So the values that incorporate and embrace ending poverty, environmental neutrality, lowering carbon emissions, will increasingly be recognized as part of the process of doing regular business, and for a long time, a big part of this has been the close to 40% of the customers in the world who live on less than $2 a day. They've been pretty much ignored. One of the issues that companies that are international will need to face much more specifically is that if a company is launched who is able to serve the mass market of individuals who are bypassed, who earn less than $2 a day, a company that does that and has a base, a scalable base in that market, will be able to compete very effectively in the richest 10% of the world's customers as well. And I think that is what will bring about the biggest change. It'll be actual competition in the marketplace.
Companies like General Electric and things like that that have developed these really medical devices at a fraction of the cost they would be in the West, and then they would in turn that they're being sold into the developed markets and are far better equipped but more economical and so forth.
General Electric is definitely moving in this direction, but it's still, as a large organization, it has some challenges in moving across all fronts very quickly. So that, as a specific example, an organization that I founded called DREV, designed using, taking advantage of a group of young people who had a different idea, designed a way of shining light on premature infants that have jaundice at birth. So neonatal jaundice can be addressed effectively by shining a bright light on the skin of the infant. Until not so long ago, the top technology for doing this cost thousands of dollars. DREV designed a technology called Brilliance, which cost $400 and gave the more expensive technologies a run for their money. Now GE has technologies that are competitive in that price range, and that's happening all over the place. And in other areas, GE is taking the lead in creating new technologies in the medical arena. But that's happening all over the place. So if you have a technology that is expensive and that has no major advantages over technologies that are designed to meet the specific needs of developing countries, you'll lose out. And the forces, the competitive forces in the marketplace will have a profound impact, already are having a profound impact on medical, biomedical technologies. Another technology is a $75 knee that is being rapidly adopted all over the world. But in developed countries like the UK and the United States, a knee joint costs thousands of dollars. A perfectly serviceable knee joint now is available for $75 retail. These technologies, it's not pretty, and it lacks some of the features of the more expensive knees, but there are people in Western markets that could benefit from that $75 knee.
Well, yes, it's a very optimistic scenario, well, picture, but clearly can't happen fast enough. These changes, as you say, do take time. I think somebody said, the future's already here, it's just unevenly distributed, but spreading these innovations more broadly, really, and getting scale as well. But thank you so much, Paul, for taking the time to speak to aspiring social entrepreneurs today. It's been a privilege to speak to you and hear your insight, and I wish you the very best with your initiatives to continue to develop services and products for the $2 poor.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.